we're transitioning between two systems. You could think of it generally a kind of a 20th century system, both of an economy and how we ran our economy, but also how we ran our kind of social apparatus, how we took care of mentally ill, how we took care of elderly. We're kind of moving to a 21st century kind of version of this, and I think what we're just seeing the beginnings of is kind of getting the traction. The economy is starting to get on this footing, on this new kind of footing, on this new technological footing. We're just now starting to move into what you could say the next story is how we start to transform education, our civil society, our kind of governments, our all the kind of nonprofit world that often the left is kind of focused on. Those haven't really been transformed yet by these new technologies, these new kind of approaches, these new ways of organization that the economy is already starting to really grip on. And we're starting just to move into that era, but I think the next 5-10 years here, we're going to see an absolute transformation of that world. We're going to see the same kind of innovation and explosive kind of new ideas that's happening in the economy now. We're going to start seeing that applied to this nonprofit world, to the education world, and again to the government world. And I think that's the kind of next big story, and that's the one to really that the communities that are listening to this station actually start to really put their energy into.
For all of the long boom that you're talking about, a whole lot of folks, probably even a majority, are not participating in this boom, and with regard to modern technologies, are being left behind. So you think that's going to change? You think that we're not going to get further divided between the haves and the have-nots?
Absolutely. Well, I mean, it does take some political will. I mean, you have to actually make it happen. Again, this isn't totally inevitable, but the trends are all moving in the positive direction. For example, the cost of technologies are just dropping dramatically. There's a whole movement now, as Robert mentioned, there's a whole idea of kind of a free software, what they call open source software. It's in other words, give software away, give products away, make them free, basically, as well as, again, the hardware. The computer devices are getting down to the point where they're getting to the price points of what toys cost now, $100, $200 to actually be able to connect to the Internet. And plus, there's now incentives, again, business incentives to actually give away these computers or get them into all classrooms or get them into the homes of low-income people. So I would say that, granted, there still is a divide. It's a problem. We have to work on it. But, in fact, it's becoming a problem that many, many people are starting to address, not just in the political realm, but also in the private sector. And I think that's a problem that's going to actually, 5 years from now, that is not going to be our problem. Well, I think the prison state is actually a legacy of the early part of basically the 20th century, but also the early parts of this long movement. Again, the darker, difficult restructuring, many poor, many unemployed kind of sections of it. I don't think it's actually the strategy of the going forward kind of long boom or the kind of 21st century politics here. I think it's an old legacy of, frankly, a lot of Republican administrations and solutions to hardcore kind of restructuring.
Shut the hell up, Peter Lighton. This is ridiculous, yapping about the prison state as the legacy of the 20th century in its darker period. And that had to do with the restructuring of the period for the poor and unemployed. First of all, the prison system's part of the darker period, all right. It's part of the destruction of the Reconstruction period, which was to imprison the free blacks to control the black population. It has nothing to do with crime except white racist capitalist crime of that period. What do you think the black codes were enforced for? Black person had to work for a white, otherwise you go to prison. The slave prisons, or the former slave prisons, working for your former slave owner. Then he has the nerve to talk about free software, open source software, hardware, giveaway of computers to low income and all that stuff. Yeah, that's because those same goons are Mickey Mousing, McDonaldizing the Internet. In other words, consumerizing, commercializing it for their consumer capitalist control. It's slave revolt time. You're listening to 104.1, 93.7, 96.3, and love.com, the Slave Revolt Radio Time. Tonight, we have Gerald, who's going to kick it off with the Making It Plain news update, as he'll be blasted into Praise Pops and Fallen Heroes. Yeah, we'll see about that. The craze for the cops is true, though. And then how the government attempts to censor unions. And then the true meaning of the International Women's Day. Then I'll be blasting into a commentary on this whole aspect of the control of athletes in sports. So we have all that and a hell of a lot more on 104.1. Slave Revolt Radio.
I went shopping for a new wallet yesterday afternoon on Westchester Avenue in the Bronx. The old wallet was in fairly good condition, and I had become accustomed to the soft, worn leather in my pocket. But familiar or not, it had to go. It was, you see, a black wallet, much too dangerous to carry these days around the inner city. I stopped at Jack's Discount, which is a few blocks away from where Amadou Diallo once lived. Jack's is one of those places that sells everything from roach motels to living room sets, but not wallets. At a tiny stall outside, a young black man was hawking knit caps, gloves, and scarves. At the back of the stall were several small stacks of men's wallets. "Let me see those," I said. "$5," the young man said in an accent I couldn't quite place. The stack, however, was mostly black. Men's wallets have never been fashion statements. "Any other colors?" He pulled a lone dark brown from the bottom of one pile. I frowned. He plucked a dark blue from the bottom of another pile. "No good," I said. You heard of Amadou Diallo?" "Amadou," he said. His words sounded like a war cry. I don't know from that." I pressed him for another color. From the bottom of the third pile, he snatched up two light tan ones with an ugly crown pattern and the word Marcus stamped all over them. That would have to do. Around the corner from Wheeler Avenue was Beeper Care Center. Black cell phones and black beepers are now another problem. Maria Martinez was standing behind thick plexiglass in the store talking to a customer. On display in the window were faceplates for cell phones. There was a lime green plate and a flaming orange plate and a pink neon plate. "How much for those?" I asked her. "They're $15, $20, or $30. Depends on the phone and the brand of the plate," she said. "Nokias are the most expensive. Some customers buy different ones to match what they're wearing." I asked about the beepers on display. They came in a dozen bright colors, even yellow. "Same price in color or black," Martinez said. "The kids prefer colors. Standard telecom makes them. But the Motorola only come in black. They're top of the line. Don't need any color when you're on top."
Some enemies. In fact, I think we'd be fooling ourselves if we had an audience this large and didn't realize that there were some enemies present.
Sisters, I'm Gerald Smith. And this is your Making It Plain news service. Right off the top, we want to talk about the true meaning and necessity of International Women's Day. I guess very often when we have these days, Black History Month, International Women's Day, or Women's Month, or whatever, people think that it really loses its meaning. Well, get an earful of this. A pregnant Indonesian maid has been sentenced to be stoned to death. An Islamic tribunal in the United Arab Emirates has ordered a pregnant Indonesian maid to be stoned to death for adultery. This tribunal of the United Arab Emirates ordered this pregnant maid to be stoned because she had committed adultery, I guess. The same court in the Indian Ocean Emirate of Fajara acquitted her Muslim Indian lover in absentia. The man had reportedly fled the country. But 35-year-old Kartine Karakender received the maximum sentence from the Sharia court on Sunday, this past Sunday. She was arrested after police were informed she was pregnant out of wedlock. Death sentences, though unusual for adultery in the Federation of Seven Emirates, has been served for this woman. In October, the Sharia court sentenced 4 male and 3 female Asian workers up to 15 months in prison and 75 to 1,000 lashes each for adultery. Yay. Okay, now.
But that's like, you remember when Sam was off killing a bunch of Iraqis during the Persian Gulf so-called war, really massacre, and Sam's friend was, of course, Saudi Arabia, who let them have their little airplanes and use their bases and stuff like that. Well, an interesting thing happened because a little corporate press writer who was back in the whole war got shooken up one day as he was walking through the capital of Saudi Arabia, which is Riyadh. And all of a sudden he saw this ambulance come whistling through the neighborhood, stop, pull out a woman, pull out a body bag, throw the live woman in the body bag, throw her on the ground, and then a dump truck full of rocks come and dump all the rocks on her and crush her to death. This is the high-tech version of stoning. She was accused of adultery.
Man, I tell you what, you want to talk about a social revolution, you let these idiots try some old crap like that over here. Americans may not be getting it on the way we need to, but I think that might just be the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back. Yes, long live International Women's Day. Know the existence of millions and millions of women all over this world. Absolutely horrible. Yet another reason for a social revolution. Well, we've got crazed cops have become fallen heroes. Yeah, check this out. A cop would probably say it's unfair, just coincidence. But the news stories are coming over the brow of the hill now and shoulder to shoulder, and they do spell out a larger message. The police chief of Los Angeles, Bernard C. Parks, announces his department's reckoning that 99 people were framed by the disgraced ex-officer-turned-informant Rafael Perez and his partners. Parks is calling on District Attorney Gil Garcetti to dismiss the cases en masse. He doesn't want it to drag on. That's not surprising. Prolongs the humiliation and people's change of consciousness. Illinois Governor George Ryan suspends his state's imposition of the death penalty, declaring that, and I quote, he cannot support a system which is proven so fraught with error, unquote. Since 1977, Illinois has executed 12 and freed 13 from death row after their innocence had been conclusively established. In New York, four officers have recently been cut loose, did not even spend the night in jail, for fatally killing an unarmed man, Amadou Diallo, with 41 bullets shot at him, 19 striking his body. A generation's worth of so-called wars on crime and glorification of the men and women in blue have engendered a culture of law enforcement that all too often is viciously violent, contemptuous of the law that they are sworn to uphold, morally corrupt and brazenly confident of the credulity of the courts. In Los Angeles, prosecutors and judges chose to believe Perez and his partners as they perjured themselves in case after case, year after year. In Chicago, police ignored witnesses and discounted vital testimony as they bustled the innocent on death row. In New York, a plainclothes posse of heavily armed cops roamed the streets confident that their lethal onslaught would receive official protection, which it did, until an unprecedented public uproar brought the perpetrators to court, and they have been since set free. Just a little sidebar, folks. Get this. I said on the radio that 56,000 people had been frisked by this street crime unit. That was a terrible mistake. I'm so sorry, and I apologize to you for that error. The correct figure is the following. In the last 2 years before Diallo was killed, 140,000 people were stopped and frisked by report. That is, these are when the officers stop and frisk people and then write a report. Of those 140,000, about 20% were arrested or brought in for some charge. And of those 20%, less than 10% of them were convicted of a crime in a court of law. That means charges were eventually dropped. Now, according to law enforcement, not me, law enforcement, only 1 in 5 frisks were actually reported. Now let's put this together. That means that something like 500,000 people were actually stopped and frisked in New York. Now do you know why the unprecedented outbreak of protest took place when Diallo was killed and everybody knew it was the street crimes unit? They had frisked half the damn city. Well, no, half of the black people. It's ridiculous. Well, sad thing is these are not isolated cases. There isn't a state in the union where cops aren't perjuring themselves, using excessive force, targeting minorities. Those endless wars on crime and drugs, a staple of 90% of America's politicians these last 30 years, have engendered not merely our 2 million prisoners, but a vindictive hysteria that pulses on the threshold of homicide in the bosoms of many of our so-called uniform law enforcement officers. Time and again, one hears stories attesting to the fact that they are ready at a moment's notice or a slender pretext to blow someone away. Beat them up. Beat him to a pulp, throw him in the slammer, sew him up with police perjuries and snitch-driven charges, and try to toss him into a dungeon for a quarter of a century or more. Now, brothers and sisters, I got some good news for you, I guess. And that is, this good news is that people are becoming increasingly aware of all of this. The bad news is that just a few days ago, I think it was March 1st, yet another New Yorker, black man, was gunned down in New York City, like three blocks from where Amadou, two blocks from where Amadou Diallo was killed. Just 3 days ago. The brother's name was Malcolm Ferguson, and what they're pushing real big with this is that the brother had been arrested for a drug offense and had just completed his parole. It's also a known fact that he was arrested the night that the cops were cut loose, that the four policemen that murdered Diallo were cut loose in Albany as part of a demonstration of about 200 to 300 people that gathered spontaneously up in the Bronx across the street from Diallo's house. His friends believe that the reason he was killed is because he was in that rally. It is hard to know the facts, but one thing is very clear. When the police were passing this neighborhood, they saw some people in the hallway, and blood broke. He ran. Something happened on the second floor, we don't know. But we know this, that the Latino officer that killed him was so close to him with the gun that there was blood on the gun.
We also know that he had a $5 million lawsuit against the police for them doing a job on him at an earlier period.
Wow, well, you know, here we get more facts. I can't get it from the New York Times, bro. Don't be looking at me crazy. The New York Times ain't gonna help me with all of it. All they want to do is tell me the boy used to sell dope. You understand? But I tell you what, this is... Man, now, of course, after he's dead, they say they found a quantity of heroin on him. I don't know about that either.
Right, right. They initially didn't say that when they came out with their first reports.
Right.
But kind of like a lot of other things we've seen gone down, you know, Oswald and all of that other stuff. They start getting their story a little bit more and more together as time rolls on.
Yeah, that's about the truth. They got to get their story together. That's about the truth of it. Well, let me get my story together here and just say it's pretty clear what needs to happen. Not only a leap in consciousness, but we need a leap in organization, because organization is the key. We better get together and do something, because there is no one that is suppressing their genocidal impulse against black people. Who's going to do it? I think black people are going to have to lead this fight to beat back the acceptance of police murder. We have a comparison for you now. We want to compare two different nations. This is a tale of two countries. Okay? In the Caribbean. 45 years ago, Cuba and Haiti shared roughly the same socioeconomic characteristics and roughly the same political system. That is, they were both neo-colonial countries under the same master, SAM, the United States government. Your government. Back then, the entices of social health were far closer than they are today. Those indices being health services available, life expectancy, infant mortality, child mortality, and literacy. All right? So they were very similar 45 years ago. But since then, Cuba had a social revolution. They threw out the United States companies and nationalized instead of privatized. They were very hard on Batista's inner military circle, and they tried and executed over 700 of them. There have been no extrajudicial executions by government forces in Cuba since the revolution. Haiti, on the other hand, has remained under the control of the bastion of the free market. The Haitian government's have allowed the country to remain under the economic domination of the United States. And Haitian authorities have been complicit in tens of thousands of extrajudicial killings of Haitian citizens. They call it the Tutu Macon. And that started by the CIA, by the way. Disappeared hundreds. Just recently, I'm talking about women. How do you pronounce your brother's name?
Aristide?
Yeah, with Brother Aristide that won the election. A player in both countries has been the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States of America. In Haiti, the CIA has maintained a close relationship with the security forces, both official and unofficial, and actually had several coup makers from 1991 on the payroll. In Cuba, of course, they have worked tirelessly, if often blunderingly, to topple the socialist regime through invasions, bombings, assassination attempts, germ warfare, and a near-complete economic blockade of the island for over 35 years. Let's compare the figures now for these two countries. One, which has remained under the sway of the capitalist master to the north, the other, that has become the wayward child and told Uncle Sam to shove off. Infant mortality. In Cuba, there are 8 per 1,000 live births, rivals the United States. Haiti, 133 per 1,000 live births. Child mortality, that is, children that die under the age of 5 years old. Cuba, 10 out of every 1,000. Haiti, 195 out of every 1,000. Literacy, Cuba, 95%. Haiti, 15%. Unemployment, Cuba, 8%. Haiti, 70%. Doctor to population ratio, Cuba, 1 for every 200 citizens. Haiti, 1 for every 7,180 citizens. Life expectancy, Cuba, 76 years for females, 72 years for males. Haiti, 55 years. I think these figures should encourage Haitians to quit complaining about the interference of the U.S. Laboata in the elections, about privatization that will turn Haiti's treasury over to the transnationals, and about U.S. embassy bullying to get the, quote, great unwashed back in line. This is solid evidence that Haiti should take all direction from the U.S. and, for goodness sake, stay away from those awful Cubans. After all, the Cubans have only assisted Haiti with fisheries, set up programs for Haitians to attend medical school, and sent 400 doctors to the country. The U.S., on the other hand, is in the process of building a beautiful new military base in Cap Haitien, a real boon to the Cap following economy, without the least input from the Haitian people and without the knowledge of the American people. Quite a comparison, this Cuban comparison.
And this is by design, because when Aristide got elected by about 67% of the vote, by the way, America had their little puppet candidate. He got about 13% of the vote. Sam got upset. Nestle's chocolate got upset. Spalding Baseball got upset. Mickey Mouse, i.e. Walt Disney, got upset. And they started to help fund a oppositional group, which of course translated into funds going into the CIA, which created a group called FRAP, a terrorist group led by Emmanuel Constance. Emmanuel Constance goes on his terror campaign, runs Aristide out of Dodge, hack up people, slice them up, put things in proper order. And now, after a job well done, Emmanuel Constance is kicking it in New York, living the high life and stuff, while the Haitians go back deeper and deeper into their misery. Now, as part of that aspect that Gerald was kicking off about the hospitals, there's been an intentional reduction of hospitals by the whole structural readjustment mechanisms that were thrown in place by the world capitalists, and Sam in particular, because under structural adjustment, the Haitians, just like other countries who are forced under that mechanism, had to reduce the amount of social services that are, you know, implanted into the country and put them all towards the privatization, which is supposed to work for a trickle-down effect years later. Of course, what's being trickled down is their own blood and bullets and things of that particular nature. And, of course, sweat, as they work to death in the sweatshops. So this is the way the game is intentionally, structurally played. This after the brothers and sisters in Rwanda who went under the same regime.
Well, here we have, things are looking up on the question of the death penalty in America. We have a judge that has seen fit to actually release a death row prisoner because his lawyer was asleep at the trial. This is amazing. From Austin, Texas, after 16 years on death row for a 1984 murder conviction in which his lawyer slept through long portions of the trial, Calvin Gerard Burdine today was ordered released from prison by a federal judge because state prosecutors missed the procedural deadline for granting him a new trial. The judge, David Hettner, of Federal District Court, who voided Mr. Burdine's conviction last year based upon the behavior of Mr. Burdine's lawyer, had given prosecutors 120 days to set a court date. The deadline passed in January, and today Judge Hittner ordered Mr. Burdine released from prison within 5 days, although he did not bar prosecutors from retrying Mr. Burdine. The judge's order said a retrial would provide Mr. Burdine with another lawyer, affording him his constitutional right to counsel. Thus, a new trial would not violate Mr. Burdine's constitutional rights, according to the order. This is a wonderful development for Texas in that there is someone looking out for the citizens and trying to keep them alive in the face of bad lawyering, said William Moffitt, president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys in Washington. Mr. Burdine was convicted in a state court in Houston on April of 1983 for the stabbing death of his former housemate and companion, W.T. Wise. The conviction was upheld by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in 1986, but last September, Mr. Burdine appealed the conviction in federal court and won when Judge Hittner ruled that sleeping counsel is equivalent to no counsel at all. At the time, the judge ordered the state either to retry Mr. Burdine or to free him within 120 days of the ruling. In today's order, Judge Hittner appeared to be irritated with state prosecutors when he wrote, "Throughout its brief, the state seeks to minimize its failure to comply with established procedural rules as excusable neglect. However, a similar procedural error by defense counsel in a capital case could result in a defendant's execution. Contacted today in his Houston office, Judge Hittner refused to comment on the case." You know what, though? How? 16 years? Wow. That's mighty white of him.
And it's also pretty sad on the standpoint that it's a long time in coming, because it wasn't too long ago before when a judge also ruled that the law requires you have a lawyer. And that doesn't mean that the lawyer has to stay awake. So, you know, when someone else had appealed before concerning that aspect.
I mean, how can you say some stupid shit like that?
Hey, they just look outside, see the working class masses worrying about what Sprewell's doing. Say, yeah, it's clear. Let's act a fool.
Yeah. I guess. Well, on February the 19th, there was an emergency conference organized by to save the life of Mumia Abu-Jamal, organized by the various forces involved in that defense campaign. The following is a report as to what happened. I was there, so I think it's important that people know how people are organizing to struggle to make to create the atmosphere in which Brother Mumia Abu-Jamal can be set free. A number of individuals from the San Francisco Bay Area who went to the emergency conference to save the life of Mumia came together, you know, and we talked about issuing a joint report. Now, everyone who attended the conference thought it went fairly well. Some people commented that they liked it better than the March 6th UC Berkeley Mumia conference, because that conference tended to be more educational in its tone, and this conference was seriously trying to take care of business. Some people felt that this was more of an organizing conference, and that the people there genuinely tried to make it so, and trying to figure out ways to implement the suggestions of the people and turn these suggestions into actions. One person thought the best part was the evening session, to hear the report back on what occurred during the day and to hear about Mumia's story, his story told by Michael Tarif Warren, Lynn Washington, and Rosemary Mealy. Well, there were proposals from various workshops that were attended. One workshop was the mass mobilization. And this workshop, you know, they tried to get people to make announcements about the various upcoming events that were being planned, like February the 28th, where there was a nonviolent civil disobedience in both Washington, D.C. and in the Bay Area on the same day. May 7th, there's going to be a Madison Square Garden event to raise funds for the legal defense. May 13th, we're going to that's in New York, and out here in the Bay Area, May 13th, the Western Regional Mass Mobilization will be held in San Francisco. Descending on Los Angeles for the Democratic National Convention, and in Philly for the Republican National Convention, and to have a mass mobilization in Philly for the first day of oral arguments, when Mumia will be in court. Now, that would be mostly East, you know, East Coast people. There was an educators workshop, which was attended by about 40 people, in which there was a concerted effort to figure out ways to accomplish getting the educators ad into the New York Times by contacting other teachers, social workers, and college professors to support the youth efforts in holding teach-ins and assemblies on April 5th, and to maintain a group network to get reports around the various activities teachers would be involved in, like the Los Angeles teach-in that occurred on February the 24th. The classroom activities other teachers are involved in with their students to share experiences and work with one another so that the others can learn from the experience, as well as share in on the questions and figure out ways of resolving other problems they face. There was a media workshop, and mostly people sharing experience once again and trying to figure out ways to get Mumia's story into the mainstream media. They attended the workshop and shared experience and sent out packets of information about the case of Mumia to reporters and followed up with phone calls. Now, this is a good thing to do, and we're going to probably be doing this out here. It was reported that Bob Herbert, a reporter for the New York Times, who has written articles about police brutality, said he had tons of information on Mumia, but that inside the New York Times, there was a ban on having articles printed on Mumia until Mumia himself speaks on the case. And that's probably so. Now, the reason that that's grossly unfair is that Mumia's got the damn sense not to speak on the case until he's in a court of law in a new trial. Why should he speak on the case until it actually matters, you know, until it could do something, i.e. in front of a jury? Now, people at the workshop said it would be great to try to get information around and expose the, to the general public to create more controversy around Mumia and generate press as well. So they had a, we had a black community people of color workshop in which people were talking about how to get this case into the black community. We talked about methods like mass distribution of leaflets, collecting signatures for petitions at places where people of color frequent, supermarkets, malls, that kind of stuff, to get Mumia's case on local cable television shows and or community college radio. Encourage entertainers to speak out for Mumia, and on the radio, sharing information about Mumia across the ethnic color lines, visiting Native Americans or Asian community community organizations with information, leafleting people in movie lines like The Hurricane or The Green Mile, reaching out to people beyond the activist circles, to organizations like fraternities. Yes, there was a lot of ideas in that. I was in that particular workshop. Then we had the labor workshop, which was attended by 33 people. The average age was considerably higher. The Bay Area representative showed a video clip of the ILWU West Coast longshoremen shutting down the ports for Mumia Abdul-Jamal on April 24th. And they also showed people discuss rather labor resolutions that have been passed for Mumia Abdul-Jamal from the various unions. Quite a lot of that. And it was very rewarding to see how many trade unions had passed these resolutions. Also, trade unions had donated buses, just made buses available so people could go to Philadelphia or go to Washington, D.C. Remember, the trade unions do have some resources. So that's a very important arena to bring this issue. There was also religious workshops, legal workshops, youth workshops. I think the youth workshop might have been the biggest one, 150 people. And based on the message people got from the conference and the workshops they attended, that what individuals felt would their focus would be in the next period would be, I think, to build these major mobilizations and also to pay attention to this movement for moratorium of the death penalty. That was February the 19th. And that's it right now for the Make It a Plain News Service. Please, don't touch that dial.
The inaccurate statements in reviews of Silent Spring are a dime a dozen, and I shall only mention one or two examples. Time, in its discussion of Silent Spring, described accidental poisonings from pesticides as very rare. Well, let's look at a few figures. California, the one state that keeps complete and accurate records, reports from 900 to 1,000 cases of poisoning from agricultural chemicals per year. About 200 of those are from the chemical parathion alone. Florida has experienced so many poisonings recently that the state is now attempting to control and to curtail the use of some of the more dangerous pesticides in residential areas. It's also worthy of notice that during the years 1959, 1960, and 1961, airplane crashes involving crop dusting planes totaled 873. In these accidents, 135 pilots lost their lives. This very fact led to some very significant research by the Federal Aviation Agency through its Civil Aeromedical Unit. This research, which has just been reported on in brief, was designed to find out why so many of these planes crashed. And these medical investigators took as their basic premise the assumption that spray poisons do accumulate within the body of the pilot, but they accumulate within the cell where they are difficult to detect. Now, the report that was recently issued contained two very significant facts, which the researchers had confirmed. One, that there is a causal relation between the buildup of toxins in the cell and the onset of sugar diabetes. Two, that the buildup of poisons within the cell interferes with the rate of energy production in the human body. I, of course, am happy to have this confirmation that cellular processes are not so irrelevant as a certain scientific reviewer of Silent Spring has declared them to be. And this same reviewer, writing in a chemical journal, was much annoyed with me for giving the sources of my information. To identify the person whose views you are quoting is, according to this reviewer, name-dropping. Well, times have certainly changed since I received my training in scientific methods at Johns Hopkins. My critic also disapproved profoundly of my bibliography. The very fact that it gave complete and specific references for each important statement was extremely distasteful to him. This was padding, he said, to impress the uninitiated with its length. Now, I would just like to say that in Silent Spring, I've never asked the reader to take my word. I have given him a very clear indication of my sources. I make it possible, indeed I urge him, to go beyond what I report to get the full picture. And this is the reason for the 55 pages of references. You can't do this if you're trying to conceal or distort or present half-truths. Another reviewer was offended because I made the statement that it's customary for pesticide manufacturers to support research on chemicals in the universities. Now, this is just common knowledge, and I can scarcely believe that the reviewer was unaware of it because his own university is among those receiving such grants. But since my statement has been challenged, I suggest that any of you who are interested make a few inquiries from representative universities, and I am sure you will find that the practice is very widespread. In fact, a visit to any good science library will provide the evidence, because it is customary in technical papers for the authors to acknowledge the source of their funds. just an example or two gleaned at random from the Journal of Economic Entomology, a paper from the University of Wisconsin carries the note, this research was also supported in part by grants from the Shell Chemical Company, Belsicol Chemical Corporation, and Wisconsin Canners Association. Another paper from the Illinois Natural History Survey declares this investigation was sponsored by the Monsanto Chemical Company of St. Louis, Missouri. A penetrating observer of social problems has pointed out recently that whereas wealthy families once were the chief benefactors of the universities, now industry has taken over this role. Now, of course, supportive education is something no one quarrels with, but this need not blind us to the fact that research supported by the pesticide manufacturers is not likely to be directed at discovering facts unfavorable to the continuance of current practices. Such a liaison between science and industry is a growing phenomenon, but seen in other areas as well. For example, the American Medical Association, through its newspaper, has just referred physicians to a pesticide trade association for information to help them answer patients' questions about the effects of pesticides on man. Now, I am sure physicians have a need for greater information on this subject, but I would like to see them referred to authoritative scientific or medical literature and not to a trade organization whose interest it is to promote the sale of pesticides.
Sisters, now we're going to have one of Tracy's commentaries. It's a pledge allegiance to this rag.
What's your name, boy?
Mahmoud Abdul Rauf.
No, it ain't. It's Mark Chris Jackson. Now repeat it. What's your name, boy?
Mahmoud Abdul Rauf.
Clarence Thomas. What you and Ward waiting for? Swing it!
Now repeat after me. What's your name, boy? Mahmoud Abdul Rauf. Now let's get something straight here. You just do as you're told. When we say jump, you jump. When we say rebound, you better start rebounding. And when we say shoot, you best start shooting. And when we say stand, especially when it's for our national anthem, you get your black ass up and stand. What the hell you think you doing? What the hell you think we brought you here for? Your job is to play the proper role we have modeled out for you. You understand me? Boy, so when we say stand, you get your nigger ass up.
Things you want are real.
You have you to complete, and there is no
It's going to be up to him. Number one, I don't think the league can back down. I think it's, if they back down, it would be bad.
Charles Barkley.
He has to make concession. I mean, first of all, I mean, I don't know a lot about the Muslim religion.
Well, this is Charles Barkley here. An old slave master can't allow us to stand up for our rights or nothing. Or the next thing you know, we be trying to have some kind of slave revolt or something. And we be can't have that or nothing like that. You know what I'm saying? Did I say right, master?
Show me them teeth, baby!
Pledge allegiance to this rag. When word got out, sparked by a Denver radio talk show host, that Denver guard Mahmoud Abdul Rauf had not been standing at attention